to Simon Evans Goes to Market. Thank you. Hello and welcome to a new series of Simon Evans Goes to Market, a place where pounds meet puns, shares are put in the stocks, liquidity gets fidgety, and we always get high on the money supply. I did have a line about curling out the sterling, but it was next. Now, we're on to series four, and yet still we remain the free world's only comedy economics hybrid, which, to be honest, is a bit worrying. If there was any mileage in it as an idea, there would by now be an uncannily similar show on Amazon Prime, an unlicensed Korean DVD box set displayed on towels outside Selfridges, and maybe even a French version with a random burst of jazz and a presenter who rolled his R's a little more than was really necessary, taking audible lungfuls of Jutin between fiscal insights. None of these exist, and the idea is clearly a turkey. Oh, well. This series, I'll be joined as ever by ubiquitous Radio 4 presence, Financial Times guru and one-man data hoard, the one and only Tim Harford, ladies and gentlemen. Tim, it is, of course, great to see you again. The question that everyone always asks me, how can we afford you?
But it's true, the fee for the show is insultingly low, but I'm looking for opportunities to cross-pollinate. I mean, I get to, for example, advertise my range of exclusive, economically themed leisure wear, ideal for both booms and busts.
Ooh. Saucy, I quite like that. Now, one of the towering themes of this series is big data, and so I'll also be joined each week by a new Goes to Market regular who will act as our resident data expert and pop up at opportune moments to tell us how, often unbeknownst to us, we are whoring out our personal data at every turn. Our data and our dignity. Please welcome our digital data and dignity describer, Timandra Hartless, ladies and gentlemen.
Simon, just before we start, can I just check that you have got me here because of my expertise in big data and not just because I happen to be after Tim Harford in your contacts list and that the email I got wasn't actually intended for him, but autocomplete sent it to me instead. And then you felt you couldn't withdraw the invitation because I'd kept screenshots of those Snapchat pictures you sent me by accident.
This sounds like the kind of mental pathology that would evolve gradually in the mind of somebody who spent too much time analysing data, to be honest. The idea that Radio 4's booking policy would be based on the simply working through the Christian names of possible contributors in alphabetical order. Ridiculous. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our new team, Harford and Harkness. So, in this series, we're going to be looking at free stuff, or rather, as Tim has illustrated, stuff whose supporting profit structures are perhaps concealed from the immediate end user. There is famously no such thing as a free lunch, although anyone who tells you that has clearly never survived a gap year in southern Europe on leftovers in service station cafeterias. It is amazing how quickly you can adjust to a cut-and-shut moussaka diet. Several years before I knew it even came hot. Later in the series, we will be looking at philanthrocapitalism, which is free if you're suffering from the right blight, and the NHS, which is free at the point of use, but at what cost? And, of course, the ever-evolving sophistication of those who live tax-free, avoiding HMRC, the IRS, or whatever Inland Revenue is called on Elon Musk's new planet. But this week, the brave new world of tech, Google, Facebook, Pet Pinterest and Porn Free. I think I made that one up, but I haven't checked. These sites take the idea of a free lunch to a whole new order of magnitude, whole new levels of awesomeness. What is their secret? How do they make money? Perhaps they don't. Perhaps that's why they never seem to pay much tax. Social media, which was briefly called Web 2.0, and chat rooms, and before that, what are you doing up there? Transformed the way we live. We spend every spare moment now staring at our phones, on buses, while cooking, during, or increasingly instead of sex. Many of us even check our phones while we're really meant to be gawping at the TV. We experience genuine panic when we're separated from them. And it's social media which demands this devotion. The fact that we use the word phone for these devices, from the Greek for voice, is an etymological relic which conceals their true nature and appeal. If anything, actually receiving a phone call while one is updating a status or liking a dank meme is, frankly, an irritation. The idea of going somewhere that doesn't have Wi-Fi or signal now inspires the same dread that attending an event without a wet bar used to in my father's day. Yet this service, to which we are all helplessly addicted and would crawl over broken glass to access, seems largely to be available to us for nothing. Tim.
In a sense, it's free. I mean, joining Facebook and the like is almost invariably free, although the truth is that the real costs are hidden, not least the costs to the exchequer in all of these wasted man hours and woman hours. I mean, one source, frankly, a rather dodgy source, but a source nevertheless, reckons that the amount of time we waste on social media every year is worth about £25 billion. Now, even the Bank of England has started to muse in public that social media may be partly responsible for the dismal productivity performance of the UK economy recently.
I'll be honest with you, I looked up that figure of £25 billion. I went onto the internet in order to track it down. Hours later and about 15 different sites, including some very strange behaviour involving dogs. But anyway, even that isn't the whole picture, right?
No, it isn't. I mean, the Bank of England may have a point, but the real nub is the capacity that social media has to tilt you from being a producer to a consumer in a matter of moments. And on top of that, there's Facebook's capacity to understand you as nothing and no one ever has before.
Unless you own a really high-end sex robot.
Anyway, Facebook's capacity to target you with laser-guided precision, to offer you up on a platter to the highest bidder in a matter of nanoseconds, it's made it arguably the world's fastest-growing company ever.
Incredibly, as we speak, Facebook's share price is around $180. Their market capitalization is $502 billion. That looks pretty healthy for a glorified message board, I have to say, especially considering Facebook only floated as a public company 5 years ago and it actually fell in value by nearly a third in its first year. Since then, it's seen an eightfold increase in just over 4 years. I mean, that is ridiculous. What is going on?
Data. The 21st century is defining innovation. If you look at the five biggest companies in the world right now, three of them, that's Google's parent, Alphabet, Facebook, and Amazon, three of them are in the business of harvesting data. The other two, Apple and Microsoft, well, they make the threshing machinery that allows this data harvesting to happen. And then with all this data, these companies are able to forensically target advertising at us so accurately that we can't resist.
But this is ridiculous. We can all ignore ads, can't we? I mean, we've always had to ignore ads, right, Tim? Tim!
Sorry, right with you. I got an email. Apparently there's a Bella Pasta 0.3 miles from here with 40% off. What were you saying?
I was saying that we can all ignore ads. We've been learning to do that for years. I mean, it's a fundamental skill in the United Kingdom. You can get a badge for it in the Scouts.
The difference is online, they're not just ads. These are the actual shops. These are wide open doorways into fully stocked, gleaming department stores. You are carrying an actual shopping mall around in your pocket, where your favourite shop follows you around like a puppy while you chat to your mates. That pair of boots you browsed 2 days ago is hovering 6 inches in front of your nose wherever you turn your head.
No, this is true. It's enough to make you forget about the pornography. And despite being bombarded with precision advertising, we keep coming back for more because we are apparently hopelessly addicted to the process of mutual affirmation.
We are. The Guardian recently profiled a gentleman called Justin Rosenstein. He is the engineer who created the like button on Facebook.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of feels that way about himself. He is actually consumed with remorse and he's now writing code to help cure us of the dopamine addiction that the like button causes.
This reminds me of Oppenheimer watching the Manhattan Project bloom into life over New Mexico. I am become death, distractor of worlds.
There is a common mental syndrome known as Kalashnikov's regret, after the famous automatic weapon designer who apparently never anticipated that his invention might be used for some ill purpose. And the other famous one is Alfred Nobel. He funded the Peace Prize because he'd always intended that his dynamite should only be used to landscape children's playgrounds.
Cruel twist of fate. So the twin engines of Facebook success are one, a hideously addictive interface, masking two, ever more sophisticated data-gathering algorithms.
Well, that, and three, the fact that Facebook is where all your friends are. They've got over 2 billion users now. It's the most successful ecosystem since krill.
So, 2 billion users, each and every one of them completely unbearable in their own little way. What about Google? How are they making money?
Well, it's not dissimilar. Google makes about 90% of its money from advertising. But they, or strictly speaking, Alphabet, Google's parent company, has a lot of other stuff going on, like YouTube, self-driving cars, robots.
Sex robots?
I imagine they will be looking at that functionality in due course. I suppose a lifelike companion who knew what you'd been searching for recently, wasn't remotely judgmental about it, and could maintain eye contact with you while you talked about it would obviously appeal to a certain kind of individual. Now, Alphabet also has a secretive company called Calico, who apparently are working on, well, immortality.
Wow, well, I have to say, Google have already achieved that for certain comedians. Thanks to Google, that ropey review of a 2014 tour date in Exeter will be there as a monument to my human fallibility long after my physical remains have turned to ash.
Let it go, let it go. These new ventures are basically geared towards selling us more stuff, more effectively. You might think that self-driving cars is nothing to do with that, but if we're ferried around in cars, Google gets to know more and more about our lives. And so it can advertise things to us that we want to buy.
So Facebook and Google and any number of other companies are busily offering themselves to you for nothing because they want inside information. They are essentially like a high-tech version of a wartime Indo-Dutch whore who gets you pissed on champagne, offers to sleep with you and then casually quizzes you in the sticky aftermath about the invasion plans. Let's now ask Tamandra Harkness to look at exactly how this data-gathering exercise works. Tamandra, I think we have established data is the business model for social media, is that right?
Definitely.
How does it work? I mean, do they just analyse every single thing that you do on there?
It's not even every single thing you do on there. I mean, yes, they can get a lot from what you do on social media, the things you like, the things you post, the words you use, the people you know, the friends you have. But as soon as you have an app in your phone, it's getting a lot more than that. It knows where you are. It knows who you're next to. It knows, possibly if you've got the health ones, it knows how fast your heart is beating when you're next to this person. It knows from the way you're moving, it can tell whether you're walking, cycling, on a bus. It can probably analyse the vibrations and tell you what model of bus you're on.
Wow. If you're on a bus, though, you haven't got much disposable income, so it probably moves on.
That's probably the safest way to avoid adverts. More scary than that is what it infers that you don't tell it from the things that you have told it. So, for example, Simon, do you like curly fries?
I think I do, yes, from what I recall.
Well, that's good, because a Cambridge University study of what people liked on Facebook found there was a high correlation between liking curly fries and being intelligent.
Yes, I remember now. I really like them. That's right.
So they can infer a lot of very personal information from information that you do give them. They can infer things you haven't told
them. So you like a page that is dedicated to curly fries, and the next thing you know, you're getting, like,
adverts to join Mensa,
right,
for example. Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, or, you know, you like somebody else's dog picture on Instagram, and the next thing you know, you're getting adverts for dog food.
I mean, you've worked in this field and you've studied it. Is it sinister? Do we need to be worried, or are we just being... The word groomed keeps coming into my mind, but...
Like you, I'm not that worried about adverts. They're not as infallible as they like to think. Twitter, for example, I haven't told Twitter anything about me, but from my interests, which are pretty much motorbikes, maths, comedy, data, it's inferred that I am male. So I'm constantly getting adverts for beard care products. So I say, you see, they're not infallible yet. They don't know us quite as well as they think.
Is it worth trying to throw in a few curveballs to keep them on their toes? You know? Just go online and buy some Victorian erotic art on the Amazon, just to throw them off the track.
Just purely confuse them.
Yeah. I mean, if it gets delivered anyway, I mean, I suppose you might as well.
And if nothing else, it would change the range of sex robots they were offering you.
Well, this is, you know, I've teased the audience a couple of times with mentions of sex robots, and I say teased, but... social media is allowing... This is what I believe is the end game for social media. This is my own theory, is that the end game is it gathers all the information that you would want an ideal life partner to have, so that, in a way, the sex aspect of the sex robot, that's an optional extra. It's the sheer level of empathy which you... You know, once you start putting this into a human form, that could be the end of the human race.
So it's basically like... Alexa doesn't have to ask you what you're thinking all the time because Alexa knows what you're thinking.
Yeah, that's right. My sex robot doesn't understand me. Oh, you need to get the updated model. Now, Tamandra, can you explain data and price discrimination? How does that work?
Well, you see, this is very important in economics because you want people to buy your stuff at a reasonable price and you don't want to sell it too cheap for the people with lots of money.
No.
But you don't want to make it too expensive for the people with a little bit of money. Data is ideal for this because you can have this much more knowledge about the customer than they realise. To go back to your analogy about having the shopping centre in your pocket, this is like a shopping centre where not only does the sales assistant look at you as you come in, look at your shoes and work out whether to show you the expensive coats or the coats on a special offer, but in fact, they know what car you've arrived in, they know where you live, they know how many children you have.
Are you suggesting that they will change the price of the object you're buying?
Oh, yes. They will change the price of the object you're buying according to what machine you are browsing it on. If you're browsing it on an expensive phone or computer, you will be seeing higher prices.
On what sort of things? Not like a book in Amazon or something. That wouldn't change price.
Probably not a book in Amazon, but certainly flights.
Things like that
where the prices are flexible, they can tell from the signal they're getting, they can tell what device you're using, probably where you are.
So whether you're on an expensive postcode.
And not only that, but, you know, borrow somebody's really cheap old phone on the bus and book your flights on that, preferably while passing through a poorer part of town.
Food for thought. Thank you very much, Tamandra Harkness, ladies and gentlemen. So, some tech giants like Facebook might be making lots of money from the apparently free service they offer us. Others like Amazon and Uber, for example, that are not really reporting a lot of profit. Tim, can you explain how Amazon, one of the world's most valuable companies, is apparently really not making a profit at all yet?
It is curious. I mean, Amazon do a lot of different things, but the thing that they're most famous for, which is selling stuff, doesn't actually make them very much money, which is kind of odd because they do think of themselves as a shop. So just to compare it to big American retailers, Target, for example, their profit margin is more than 6%, Walmart's over 4%, Amazon's is often less than 2%, which is low. And it's strange because you'd think Amazon would be making more money because they don't have to spend cash on building stores and building car parks and hiring security guards to retrieve trolleys from canals, all that kind of stuff.
I think they're wasting a lot of money putting small things in ridiculously big boxes.
Could be that. The thing you need to understand about Amazon is they reinvest most of the money they make into one particular project, which is world domination. Now, they build more and more infrastructure, they develop new products like cloud storage and drones to deliver your parcels and Alexa, who's this handy little robot personal assistant who promises not to eavesdrop on your conversations and recommend that you buy Doritos from Amazon.
So, are you saying when I closed my website selling bow ties for dogs, bowwow.com, when I closed that after years of failing to turn a profit, I was actually bang on track to become an Amazon-style market dominator?
Well, Simon, I don't hate to break this to you, but the problem with BowWow.com, other than the choking incidents, was that investors probably didn't have confidence that one day it was going to be a worldwide market leader in canine neckwear. Whereas companies like Uber, despite a rough ride and some recent negative publicity, have generally been successful in attracting investors. Last year, Uber posted a $2.8 billion loss, but they had a turnover of $20 billion, and they're growing. And at this point, as much as with Thursday school dinners, turnover is king. Even for Uber, though, it might not happen. As with all business, it's a gamble.
Tim is right, ladies and gentlemen. A glance at the history of social media shows that other citadels of commerce have risen and fallen. Facebook is huge now, but remember MySpace, Bebo, Bow Wow Buddies, my thwarted attempt at dogs-only social networking?
Yeah, the route to the digital summit is littered with the frozen corpses of people who've tried and failed. For example, Among the earliest British attempts to harness the power of people's desire to connect was Friends Reunited. Launched in 2000 as the brainchild of Steve and Julie Pankhurst and their friend Jason from Barnet in Hertfordshire.
Wow, so Barnet became a genuine threat to the supremacy of Silicon Valley.
Friends Reunited proved enormously popular for a while. By 2005, it had over 15 million British users, and it was then bought by ITV for £175 million.
Presumably with a view to turning it into a format of some sort, probably involving Paddy McGuinness in a pair of school shorts.
It's a striking image. Be that as it may, 2 years later, ITV sold this Koh-i-Noor diamond of the web for 25 million quid, which is one-seventh of its original purchase price, and they sold it to DC Thompson, who published the Beano.
Perhaps looking for new storylines for the Bash Street Kids, featuring Paddy McGuinness as Pug.
No doubt. Anyway, by 2016, Friends Reunited had closed entirely. Although, happily, its ex-employees can still track one another down using Facebook.
Well, it's a cautionary tale. Could the same fate befall Facebook? Should it, even? To find out just how we could be investing in these tech giants to our own financial advantage, I spoke to editor-in-chief of Money Week, our go-to-market regular personal finance guru, Merin Somerset Webb. I started by asking Merin whether I'm an idiot for not investing in social media earlier and whether I'm too late.
Simon, you are an idiot.
Yes.
Should have been invested
a long
time ago.
OK, that's good.
Is it too late? Very possibly,
be more
yes.
stern. Be harsher.
Yes, you should have seen it coming.
Yeah.
Lots of people did. Lots of fortunes have been made out of investing in social media.
As you can probably tell from that little clip, for some reason, I take a certain pleasure out of being told off by financial experts. If you ever see me being manhandled out of a Nat West, take heart in the knowledge I'm loving every second of it. But next, I asked Merin if, despite being late to the party, there is any way to make money here.
So is there any value in anticipating the new stuff? I mean, I've got a 13-year-old daughter, and I think I should be leveraging her in terms of, you know, any platform she adopts with her friends. I should be going, oh, you use BitchUp or something. And I'd say, oh, that's interesting.
Lots of these companies, the real growth, generally, these days, comes before they're listed.
Yeah.
And you can't access that anyway.
You with the Kickstarter even?
Well, the Kickstarter maybe, but how are you going to know you're an amateur investor looking on a crowdfunding?
Yeah,
how are you going to know what the app is? The best way, actually, in the end, to get into new growth technology companies, because the likes of us are never going to figure out which one they are, Google, for example. If you buy Google, which is extremely expensive, of course, but nonetheless, they're the ones who buy all these small companies that are going to be successful and interesting.
And any other sort of insights about what might be a way to play the increasing techification of the world? I mean, one thing, for instance, obviously, is Amazon themselves are looking at driverless vehicles and drones and delivery service in-house delivery services.
Don't train as a taxi driver. I can suggest that. Do not train as a taxi driver.
Well, I mean, one of the things that this is a kind of running joke on
a
running joke on social media is learn to code.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I get this. This is a bit like, you know, we used to tell everybody in the 90s to learn Japanese or in the 80s to learn Japanese, and now we tell everybody to learn Chinese. I'm sure that, you know, when my children are grown up, coding will be a very outdated thing.
Coding is creating.
Learning to code a bit like going to secretarial college in the 60s. I don't know what the right skill is for a child who's, say, 6, 7, 8, 9 now. I don't know what we should be teaching them, but I'm pretty sure it's not what we think we should be teaching them, because the world moves much faster than that.
That's the trouble, isn't it? Everything moves so quick. I mean, I think very possibly my son's best chance is to learn to commentate amusingly on his own activities on Xbox while he's doing them, and you know, become a vlogger.
Yeah. And your son is very charming, so this will work.
Merin Somerset Webb there, demonstrating the sort of financial know-how that explains why she lives a gilded existence up in beautiful Edinburgh, while the rest of us proles scrabble in the dirt. Tim, we've seen where the new money is and how these companies are using our data to make it, but what have been the costs to other businesses? Where is the money being sucked from? Who are the big losers?
Well, these old traditional ways of providing content are withering on the vine, aren't they? I mean, you and I, Simon, we're both old enough to remember saving up our pocket money, going to Woolworths, buying the latest record from the Nolans or Adam and the Ants.
Or the Berlin Philharmonic.
Sure. If you still buy CDs like some kind of dinosaur, every time you do, the artist earns an average of $2.76 per album. which means that for that artist to earn the minimum wage in the United States, they'd have to sell 457 albums a month.
Unless they're in Ladysmith Black Mambazo, of course, in which case they'd have to split it 20 ways and still give most of it to Paul Simon.
Right, but compare that to a track streamed on Spotify. When a track is streamed on Spotify, the artist gets 1/1,000th of a cent. So forget 457 albums. The truth is the traditional model has been largely replaced with a new one, and it's happened almost overnight.
So why has this happened? Why have the artists and record labels let it happen? It appears to be legal, right?
They're mostly legal, and it's not clear they had much choice. We're used to having things for free, aren't we? You only have to look at newspapers. Oh, the problem is you don't have to look at newspapers. You read them online for nothing, often via Facebook. And you're seeing Facebook advertising. The newspapers aren't even getting the revenue from that.
So there you have it. It's a motif for the series. We are getting used to having things for free, and it will obviously have an impact. Maybe at the end of it all, the true cost of social media is the mental state in which we all now exist, the degree of distraction, the burden on the NHS of people who have wandered out into the road in front of me and haven't noticed that I'm on the phone. In a sense, we are paying for this apparently free lunch of social media. We're paying with our own mental capacity. It was traditional for the audience to, say, a Beethoven string quartet, not to mark the transition between movements with anything other than an ostentatious clearing of the throat. Now, even that tiny sliver of the population who still willingly expose themselves to the world's greatest music often applaud at the end of each movement, not so much, I suspect, in appreciation of the music itself as of their own sheer stamina in surviving perhaps 8 or 10 minutes of unbroken concentration. So, what have we learned? While Amazon's algorithms are good, they don't always work. For example, the one that says it's OK to deliver a parcel directly into your outside bin. England has postulated that social media might be responsible for the UK's dismal productivity at work, unless you're a cabinet minister, in which case it's probably a different wing of the internet altogether. In the future, the cost of a flight will depend on how new and high-tech the device is that you're using to buy it on. So for a really cheap holiday, always use a quill. You've been listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market. Good night! You've been listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market with me, Simon Evans, Tim Harford, Merrin Somerset-Webb and Timandra Harkness. The show was written by me with Benjamin Partridge, the researcher was Andrew Wright and the producer was Richard Morris. It was a BBC Studios production.